Parsha Shlach
discusses the catastrophe of the Meraglim, the spies. Moshe, the Jews, with Hashem's endorsement actually, somewhat of an endorsement, sent spies to Eretz Canaan. The spies toured the land. They came back with a report, Dibas Haaretz. They spoke about what they had seen. They somehow destroyed the morale of the Jewish people. The Jewish people became terrified. They refused to go into Eretz Yisrael. That was a terrible, terrible sin that resulted in the terrible decree against the Jews, 40 years in the Midbar. The entry into Eretz Canaan was postponed by about 40 years. As we've discussed previously, there are different opinions in the commentators about what exactly was the sin. Was the sending the Meraglim the sin? Was the report the sin? Was the Jewish people's reaction the sin? But basically, according to Pshat, a common understanding of what the problem was it was the Jews' rejection of Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael was promised to them as a great prize, as the ideal place for Jews to live. Hashem wanted them to live there. And the Jews turned their back. The Jews said, no, we're not going in. That was an unforgivable, that was just an enormous sin, and that's why they were punished so severely. Rav Yaakov Emden, in his Siddur, in Sulam Beiskel, Rav Yaakov Emden, he's actually talking about the laws of davening. He says a person should always be mechavein connected to Yerushalayim. But he goes on, and he segues from that into the importance of actually living in Eretz Yisrael. And he has a remarkably passionate and inspiring, kind of demanding tirade. He tells the reader about how important it is to live in Eretz Yisrael. He writes that everyone, every man, every Jewish person should make a solid determination internally to go to Eretz Yisrael when he can, when he has the money, when he's able to, and he has to go to Eretz Yisrael. And he goes on, and he condemns the Jewish people throughout the ages for not going to Eretz Yisrael. He says, Chas v'shalom, don't think that one can stay in Golus. This was the sin, he says, of Avoseinu HaRishonim. Back in our Pasha of the Meraglim, this was the sin of the Meraglim, the Jewish people in the time of the Meraglim. Shagarmu b'chiyah l'daros, as Chazal say, they caused perennial crying, Tisha B'Av, every year, we remember it. Kimasu Eretz Chemda, the language of Tanakh, they rejected the land of delights. And then he says, v'hi sha'am d'lanu b'goloseinu hamar. This problem has been repeated. This has been a chronic problem with the Jewish people throughout the bitter Golus. It didn't just happen once. B'chol dar, he says, we've suffered endless oppression, pogroms, endless suffering. Al tzavareinu nirdafnu, yoganu v'lahu nachlanu, he says, k'meis milev nishkachnu. Why? Why are we suffering so much? Acharei sheshachachnu diras Eretz Yisrael legamri. Because we've forgotten about the imperative to live in Eretz Yisrael. Only not one in a thousand, he said, back in his time, several hundred years ago, goes to Eretz Yisrael. Echad mi-medina, one out of an entire country, shnayim bedar, two people in a whole generation. Baruch Hashem, this is one area in which we've gotten better. Maybe because it's easier, but whatever it is, certainly the things have gotten a little better than that. He says, nobody remembers the love of Eretz Yisrael, Dere Shlomo v'Tavasa, Lomitza Pilarosa, nobody eagerly anticipates going to Eretz Yisrael. We're happy in Golos, he says. He uses a famous barbed language we find in a number of Akronim. He says, people think, Kfar Matzonu Eretz Yisrael, V'Yerushalayim Acheres, Dugmasa, we found a substitute for Eretz Yisrael. We have, whether it's Berlin or Lakewood or New York or New Jersey, we found other places which are good enough for us. Al-Kain, he says, because of this complacency, because of this failure to strive, to yearn for Eretz Yisrael, Al-Kain, Bo Aleinu, Kol Haros, B'Shevet Yisrael, B'Eretz Spania, the Jews suffered in Spain, he says, in other lands. They had shalva, they had tranquility, they had covered gadol, they had great honor, they were citizens, they were respected, they were integrated into society. He says it was close to 2,000 years from the Churban Bayis Rishon, and then they were expelled until there's nothing left of Jewry in Spain, he says. Tzadiku Hashem, Tzidok Adin, Hashem is right, he says, we deserve it. Ki yatzim idaitim legamri inin galusam b'sarvu bagayim, they forgot about the galus. Assimilation also, he says, not just Eretz Yisrael, they assimilated, they learned from the non-Jews. Tzionein Dareshla, and so on and so forth. And he goes on about the tremendous obligation that a Jew has to yearn for Eretz Yisrael, to strive to go to Eretz Yisrael, and the terrible punishment, the terrible suffering that has befallen the Jewish people because they have forgotten about Eretz Yisrael. So we'll discuss today, it's a very big topic obviously, both in halacha and hashkafa, politically. We'll try to discuss just on the surface some of the basic shita, some of the more interesting statements, some of the basic halachic arguments for and against, basic hashkafic positions for and against, whether we need to all feel guilty, whether we all need to be constantly striving to go to Eretz Yisrael or not. And we'll discuss the historical record, Jews throughout the generations. On the one hand, some achronim bring many Jews were literally moser nefesh to go to Eretz Yisrael. Many Jews were not, both great rabbis as well as ordinary people. So we'll try to discuss what the issues are for or against, what the limud zchus on is for not going to Eretz Yisrael, and so on. So in halacha, in the Gemara, in the Shulchan Aruch, the place Eretz Yisrael is discussed. This is one of the delicious things about halacha, how some of the most hashkafic and profound questions arise out of the most mundane, technical halachic discussions. The classic Talmudic discussion of going to Eretz Yisrael and the value of Eretz Yisrael is in Maseches Ksuvos, toward the end. The context is a marital dispute. The context is the two spouses, the husband and wife, are arguing about where to live. One of them wants to live here, one of them wants to live there, so who wins? Who has the right to compel the other spouse to stay, to go, forfeiture of Ksuva, etc.? So the Mishnah has different rules. One of the most famous of the rules is Hakol Malin L'Eretz Yisrael V'Ein Hakol Motzin, which at face value seems to mean if they're living in Golos and Chutz La'aretz, if either spouse wants to go to Eretz Yisrael and the other spouse doesn't, the spouse who wants to go, his or her position is the dominant one. Ein Hakol Motzin, if they both live in Eretz Yisrael and one wants to leave and one wants to stay, again, we defer to the one who wants to stay because of the value of living in Eretz Yisrael. And from this Gemara, the Gemara goes on to a general discussion about the value of living in Eretz Yisrael, the mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael, the terrible condemnation of one who doesn't live in Eretz Yisrael, and so on and so forth. And that actually causes a lot of the halachic discussion is about this link, about on the one hand there's a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael, and hashkafically and halachically there's a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael. On the other hand, this manifests itself in an Eben Ezer, in a marital halacha that spouses have the right to compel each other to live in Eretz Yisrael. And the question is, how closely are those two things linked? If one argues that the mitzvah does not apply b'zman hazeh, for various reasons that we'll discuss, does that mean that the husband can no longer force his wife to go to Eretz Yisrael, or vice versa? If some poskim say that the mitzvah, that the husband can no longer force his wife, does that imply there's no mitzvah? So exactly the relationship between this technical question about husband and wife and the broader question of the mitzvah and the hashkafah of going to Eretz Yisrael is something is not entirely clear. That the poskim occasionally debate. But in any event, it all starts from this Mishnah. The Mishnah says that spouses have the right to demand of each other that they live in Eretz Yisrael. Tosus kind of acknowledges the fact that we don't really enforce this. We don't really seem to do this b'zman hazeh. Tosus offers two reasons why. And it's a very short Tosus. It's about four lines long. And yet it's been quoted and parsed and taken apart endlessly by the later poskim. Exactly, do we paskin like these two reasons? What are the parameters of these two reasons? Tosus gives two reasons why these halachas may not apply in contemporary times. First reason is, eina noheg b'zman hazeh. It does not apply in contemporary times in, again, the medieval period, 13th century, 12th century. It doesn't apply b'zman hazeh. De'ika sakana drachim, because travel is dangerous. Sakana is danger, drachim is travel. So travel is dangerous. That's the first reason. The second reason is a bit of an odd reason. The second reason is the reason of Rabbeinu Chaim. Rabbeinu Chaim says, Achshav ain't a mitzvah lodger Eretz Yisrael. Not only is it, forget danger, it's not even a mitzvah in the first place. Yesh kama mitzvahs atluyas baretz. There are many mitzvahs that are connected to agriculture, connected to the land itself, like Truma and Meiser and Shemitah. Kama onshin, many punishments, einon yichol lizar bahem, v'lamar alem. It's difficult or impossible for us to properly fulfill the mitzvahs of Eretz Yisrael, and the punishments are severe. Shemitah, we find, v'toki aretz osam, that the land will expel you, and that terrible things will happen to you if you don't keep the mitzvahs hatluyas baretz properly. So Rabbeinu Chaim says the spiritual, the halachic burden is too great, and the spiritual dangers are too great, so we don't live in Eretz Yisrael. Rabbeinu Chaim's reason has been somewhat controversial throughout the ages. The Maharit, Rabbi Yosef of Trani, felt this was such a strange, bizarre reason. He says, it's wrong, it's not where Rav Chaim really held. It was a student who erroneously misunderstood Rav Chaim. It can't be, it just doesn't make any sense. And in general, Rabbeinu Chaim's reason was much debated by the later poskim, whether, why is it so hard, they say, to keep the mitzvahs? Have a farm and follow the halachas. It's so difficult. Shemitah, we know, Shemitah is problematic with Zman HaZeh, but a lot of mitzvahs are. Keeping Shabbos is hard, too. So the poskim debates whether, what exactly is the status of Rabbeinu Chaim's reason. Rabbeinu Chaim's reason is not brought in Shulchan Aruch. And in general, some poskim are choshishvut. Some poskim say that if a husband wants to force his wife to go to Eretz Yisrael, she can say, you know, I don't want to go because I'm worried about Rabbeinu Chaim's reason. Some say the woman can never invoke Rabbeinu Chaim's reason. She's not the one who's taking truma. She's not the one in charge of the farm. The husband is running the farm, so why is it her business? But in any event, Rabbeinu Chaim's reason is somewhat difficult to understand. And it's not, I don't think it's the mainstream approach in halacha, although some poskim are choshishvut. The first reason of Tosfos, the reason that it's dangerous, akanas drachim, that is something we find extensive discussion and debate about in the poskim. Poskim generally do agree that danger is a consideration. What kind of danger, how much of a consideration it is, that we do find extensive discussion about. Poskim do generally seem to accept a person at least is not mechuyev to go to Eretz Yisrael if it's dangerous. But the question again is, what kind of danger are we talking about? So Tosfos says again, sakanas drachim. The trip, the travel is dangerous, which was generally interpreted by the poskim to mean two things. It was interpreted to mean that sea voyages are dangerous, can be dangerous, both because of the possibility of shipwreck, storm at sea, as well as the possibility of piracy. And overland voyages were considered dangerous, depending on the circumstances, because of highwaymen, because of marauders and people who would attack you on the road. We know that we bench Gomel. We bench Gomel for four categories of salvation. Two or three of them involve travel. We have Holchei Midbaros, those who travel through deserts, and we have Yardei Hayam, those who travel on sea voyages. So Chazal in general recognized that travel can be dangerous, and so Tosfos said that because travel is dangerous, we don't go to Eretz Yisrael. We don't have to go to Eretz Yisrael. So Tosfos himself is not entirely clear, because in spite of travel being dangerous, and again, we just said, Chazal also recognized travel was dangerous, and they still said that the halacha is you have to go to Eretz Yisrael. So it seems obvious that the kind of danger that always exists on roads, or that typically existed in ancient times on roads, was not enough to change the halacha. So if Tosfos said that the travel was dangerous, Tosfos seems to have meant that in his time the dangers had increased beyond the levels of the time of the Talmud. The Rashbash, Rabbi Shlomo ben Shimon Duran, the son of the Tashbats. Tashbats is Rabbi Shimon ben Tzemach Duran, the Tashbats' son, the Rashbash, Rabbi Shlomo ben Shimon Duran. So the Rashbash has the classic discussion of danger in Eretz Yisrael and going to Eretz Yisrael. He did consider it generally dangerous. His halacha is actually brought in the Shulchan Aruch. The Beis Yosef himself, Rabbi Yosef Karo, rules pretty much, he has long tshuvas about it, but the Shulchan Aruch basically rules in summary in accordance with the conclusions of the Rashbash. So just first jump to the Rashbash's summary. The Rashbash's rule is, he says, this is Hayotze. The conclusion is, after a long tshuva, Bizman HaZeh, in these times, this is basically 15th century, Bizman HaZeh, Be'artos Halalu, what are Artos Halalu? He lived in North Africa. He was the Sephardic communities in North Africa. He says the whole land, Misof Amara, from they called North Africa the Maghreb, the west of the Middle East. The Sephardic North Africa was called the West, the Maghreb. So Misof Amara, meaning all the way from the west coast of Africa until Na'aman, which I think is Alexandria. I'm not sure how it's pronounced, but it was the way they referred to Alexandria. So the entire western half of the Mediterranean until Alexandria, Ein Kof and Lalos, the spouses cannot force each other to go because it's dangerous. From Alexandria, Lamala, from Alexandria of Egypt to Eretz Yisrael, so he says it depends. If it's If the proposed voyage is overland, you can go through Egypt, through the, you can take a caravan across the, across land, that's okay. And Derech Yam, Bimas Achama, even across the Mediterranean, if it's in the summer, Im Ein Sham Listim, if piracy is not high right now, then Baratas Halalu, then the halacha is, you can, spouses can force each other to go. Vani, he says, Meyere Hara, I'm nervous to be paskin. I'm nervous to be mekel on such things. He says karbadin zelafanai, and many times I rule they can't force each other to go. I can't rule out the possibility of danger. Earlier in the tshuva, he explains what the dangers are. He elaborates on the points we've been making that there are two kinds of danger: the danger of shipwreck and the danger of piracy and bandits. And he explains that he says even the sailors. He says even the sensible sailors, the Christian sailors, who are expert sailors, he says, I guess he felt they were better seafarers than the Muslims. He says that they weren't crazy enough to travel during the winter season, he says. He actually gives the months they would travel. He says they wouldn't go from August to March. He said nobody's crazy enough to take a voyage across the open ocean, even the Mediterranean Sea, which I don't even think is as bad as the open Atlantic or the open Pacific. But he says today it's true. He says we find sailors sailing all over the place year round. He says today people are crazy. Today people are just reckless and nimser olam biatipshim. He says today people have no sense of self-preservation, but the halacha doesn't change. Halacha says the normal prudent seafarers would not take voyages during the winter months, and as to the and because of weather, and as to the other problems, the problems of piracy and bandits on land, that depends on the circumstances, depends on the political situation, how the roads are maintained, the police forces, whatever they are. So those are judgment calls, and that's basically how the Shulchan Aruch passes. He points out, he says, the reason in the Talmud we don't find all this concern about danger, he says, the Talmud, he says, was written in Bavel and Eretz Yisrael. So there were no oceans being crossed. Eretz Yisrael itself, and Bavel is Iraq, and to the east, to the north. He says, they weren't crossing any oceans. And I guess piracy wasn't a problem back then, he says. The bandits and highwaymen weren't such a problem. But he says, certainly if you're crossing oceans are inherently dangerous. And even piracy is often a problem. So in his time, he says, danger is a problem. And this basically is the normative view of the poskim. They don't give you exact definitions how much danger is considered enough danger to change the halacha. But they basically say, kol lafi ha'inyan, you have to judge how much danger you're dealing with on that time. Now, just mentioned parenthetically, the danger that the poskim discuss, virtually all the poskim that I've seen, they discuss the danger of the trip itself, whether from piracy, from shipwreck, from bandits. Nobody really discusses the danger that living in Eretz Yisrael is dangerous because there are madmen in neighboring countries who are working on a bomb or terrorists. None of them really discuss that. There are later poskim who discuss, in general, the difficulty of living in Eretz Yisrael, Parnassa. We'll return to that a little bit later, I hope. But in general, the danger they all anticipated was the danger of the trip itself. I think it's fair to say the danger today is minimal, you know, virtually non-existent. Yes, I mean, you know, there are some plane crashes and there are some ships do get sunk. But in general, that's not something that we see as a real danger. It is true, we've discussed in the past, many poskim still say you bench gomel for these things, but the arguments they make are usually more formal. They argue that Chazal made a gzeira, it doesn't depend on the actual magnitude of the danger, or Moshe has an alumdus shesvara, but whatever it is, I think most people would accept that the danger is minimal today, and most of the concerns of the poskim would not apply. Today, when people think of danger, you send your kid to Eretz Yisrael, you worry about danger, you're not worried about a plane crash, you're worried mostly about people blowing up cafes and pizza shops in Yerushalayim. But that could also be danger. Again, the poskim don't give us exact levels of danger, but the danger that the classic poskim anticipated does not really seem to be a concern. Now, there is a very interesting related question, which is, assuming that there is danger, assuming in the Rashbash felt very strongly that in his time there was too much danger. So he's primarily discussing the question of whether spouses can force each other to go to Eretz Yisrael or not, and he says pretty strongly not because of the danger involved. This is where it's Brona Shulchan Aruch also. It's Brona Shulchan Aruch and Evan Ezer and Siman Ayin Hay, which is a discussion of spouses. There is no Siman on Mitzvah Sisha of Eretz Yisrael. The one place it's Brona Shulchan Aruch, the is in Ebenezer in the laws of spouses. When I was researching this year, the main place I looked was in the Otzer HaPoskim. They printed a wonderful Kuntres Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, several dozen pages packed with sources, everything under the sun of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Their location also is, the Otzer HaPoskim is an encyclopedic work on Shulchan Aruch Ebenezer. And in Siman Ayin Hey, they published an entire Kuntres Yishuv Eretz Yisrael discussing all the parameters of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. They located it, the one place in Shulchan Aruch where we talk about Eretz Yisrael, which is Ebenezer, the laws of spouses. So the Rashbash is primarily concerned with establishing that a spouse cannot force another spouse to move to Eretz Yisrael b'zman hazeh. The question is, may a person himself choose to go to Eretz Yisrael on his own in spite of this danger? Even if we accept that there is significant danger, does the person have the right, literally, to be moser nefesh to go to Eretz Yisrael or not? As you mentioned earlier, posts can kind of bring both things. They say, on the one hand, we find Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and others literally were moser nefesh to go to Eretz Yisrael. On the other hand, we find many Gedolim, many, most Jews throughout history did not go to Eretz Yisrael, and one of the main reasons is because it's dangerous. As a matter of fact, and again, we find language in the post in both ways. So we find it's a fascinating tshuva which they quote of the Gadol of Minsk, a leading posek in the last century. He has what appears to be a fascinating tshuva on Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. It's in a journal. I wasn't able to get a hold of the original. But he says, he's discussing this question of whether a person is allowed to choose to voluntarily risk his life to go to Eretz Yisrael. And he argues that Maisa Rav, that the precedent is that you are allowed to. He says, we have Maisa Rav, we have Harbe Gedolim, throughout the history, many Gedolim, Noharu Eretz Yisrael, B'chol Dar V'dar, they strove to go to Eretz Yisrael. Certainly in their time, all travel was dangerous. Ufkide Haaretz, and also the noblemen, the rulers, Mashlu Baritzus Ushriru Slave, they ruled by force, they ruled, there was no constitutional limits on power back then, they ruled, whatever they did whatever they wanted. Hagin Nesunim, Lashamo, Meshisa, even in Eretz Yisrael, he acknowledged even in Eretz Yisrael, life wasn't very easy, their lives were precarious. And nevertheless, we find that they did go to Eretz Yisrael in spite of the danger. The Rashbash himself, as I said, the Rashbash is kind of the prime text on this topic, the main discussion of this topic. The Rashbash himself basically contradicts himself a couple of times in his various tshuvas. He's not directly addressing the issue, but his language seems to go back and forth on the question of whether a person is allowed to risk his life to go to Eretz Yisrael. He says, he's trying to establish that certainly you don't have to and a spouse can't force. So he says, why didn't Chazal make this exception? It's a major exception. So he says, why didn't Chazal tell us this? So he says, Chazal didn't have to tell you this. He says, Ein tzarach la'amro b'divrayim. He says a famous expression. He says, I'm not sure where it comes from, an old kind of aphorism. He says, the words of Chazal, lohayu, Chazal spoke, they assumed that those who were listening to them, those who were reading them, were wise people, couldn't understand and add the appropriate conditions. They weren't speaking to fools, he says. They took for granted, if I tell you, you have to go out to Israel, you'll figure it out for yourself, but not if it's dangerous. So he says that, and he says that in general, we know the rule is, B'chol bal sechel, he says, every person who has any sense in his head, makir, understands, shema makom sakana, prohibited to risk one's life. So it sounds very much like he's saying that even in his context of the great mitzvah of Eretz Yisrael, not only are you not obligated to go to Eretz Yisrael, it sounds like he's saying that you are not even allowed to. Yet in other tshuvas, he seems a little bit more circumspect. In the end of Siman Gimel, his discussion in Siman Gimel, for example, it's a Siman Aleph. In the end of his discussion in Siman Gimel, he says, again, the halacha is, you can't force someone else to go to Eretz Yisrael, it's too dangerous, he says. And he winds up, his concluding line is, v'chol echad ba'atzma yishayr. Everyone should make his own decision. It's up to you, he says. You should decide for yourself, imrotzi l'sakin atzma yala. You want to risk your life, go to Eretz Yisrael. Imlav yechdal, and if not, not. Here he seems to explicitly accept that person is allowed to make his own decision, is allowed to say, Eretz Yisrael is so important to me, doing the mitzvah is so important to me, living in the land of God is so important to me, I would like to risk my life to go to Eretz Yisrael. Similarly, in Siman Beis, the middle tshuva, He gives a bunch of reasons, including Parnassa and some other reasons we'll discuss soon maybe, why people don't have to go to Eretz Manazeh. And he says, about these reasons, he says that... He says, there's no doubt that going to Eretz Israel is a great mitzvah, mitzvah gedola, always. However, he says, there are various reasons why you might not have to go. And he gives a list of reasons. And he says, because of all these reasons, many gedolim didn't go to Eretz Israel. He says, but the Yesh Tzas, there were some people, many gedolim didn't go, but there were some people who are not worried about these things. And then Basin Matuvin Lafrisha, Basin doesn't have to interfere. If they want to go, Basin lets them go. So again, some of the reasons were Parnassa, other reasons, but even danger, he does list danger as one of the reasons people didn't go. And he still says that Basin doesn't have to stop you if you want to go. And not only that, but they bring that his own father, the Tashbatz explicitly says that you're allowed to go even if there is danger. The Tashbatz says... Tashbat says, again, like his son says, like the Gadol of Minsk says, Chachmei Yisrael, ha'yimisaknim ba'atzmam, laver naharis, gelikonis l'Eretz Yisrael. Sages of Israel used to risk their lives to cross rivers to get into Israel. They would say, Moshe and Aaron didn't make it. I'll do whatever I can. I'll take any chance I can. There's such a valuable prize. I'll do whatever I can to whatever I can, and so on. So there were poskim who held that, again, the level of risk is not well defined by the poskim. How much risk we're talking about is not clearly defined. But at least some level of risk, the poskim felt that, some poskim at least felt that you're allowed to. Other poskim felt differently. Lavush says, Osir. Chavis Yar says, better not, better stay home if it's dangerous. There were poskim who said, Osir. But again, it's very hard to compare one to the other. Not always clear how much danger each one was talking about. I assume if we're dealing with, you only have a 1 in 10 shot of making it alive, maybe everyone would say you shouldn't do it. If it's only 1 in a million, maybe everyone would say you should. So it's very hard. This is all a separate topic we've discussed in the past about risk and how much risk are you allowed to take in halacha and hagash shalolam. Very difficult and difficult to define topic. But in any event, we do find poskim on opposite sides of the issue on whether, at least the words they use, they take almost opposite language on whether a person is allowed to assume a real and considerable and definite level of risk or not.
So you just alluded to the general question. I mean, is this different than other mitzvahs like sukkah? Let's say there was a sukkah for me to send the sukkah. So would that be?
So that's a good question, and it is very unclear. Recently, I was speaking about mitzvah of milah. So on the one hand, we all know that we are very quick to push off milah if there's any danger. On the other hand, milah itself is inherently, at least it was, certainly in the time of Chazal, was slightly dangerous, or more than slightly dangerous. The Gemara says in Gittin, in the Gad to the Chorban, the Gemara brings the Pasuk, Ki alecha haragnu kol hayom, that we are killed for your sake, for the sake of heaven all day. One of the interpretations of that thing is Zumila, and Rashi, Shinit Bashmini, and Rashi says, Zimnin Demayas, that people sometimes die because of Mila. So I was discussing, there are some very interesting tshuvas, where some posts can actually establish a doctrine that Mila has a higher standard of risk in Rechayiv to accept than other mitzvahs, because since the Torah explicitly told you to do Mila, in spite of the fact that there is inherently danger, the Torah therefore must be saying that a certain level of risk is acceptable for Mila. So even though it remains true that any unusually significant amount of risk, we will push off Mila, but there are posts that will actually say that the mere fact that you found an elevated than normal risk is not always enough of a reason. This comes up, for example, in the discussions of Matzitza Bepeh. Not a topic I'm not familiar with, not a topic I want to get into, but sometimes people will argue that you can show statistically there is some slight increase in risk, and some posts will counter, it doesn't matter, because halacha doesn't always require, in general, in all mitzvahs, in milah specifically, halacha doesn't necessarily require that every statistically measurable non-zero risk has to be avoided, that for certain mitzvahs in particular, milah, according to some posts, milah has a, there's another case that comes up. There was a great battle in the 19th century about burial, where apparently there were some diseases, maybe cholera, where people looked pretty dead, they looked insensate, but they didn't have such reliable methods of determining death, and there was apparently a serious problem, people were getting buried alive. So the European governments passed laws that a corpse should not be buried until several days had passed after the death, to make sure he's really dead. So post can have to grapple with this. Normally there's a halacha against doing that. It's not appropriate to delay a burial. So the question was, do we have the right to delay the burial? So one of the questions was, forget the law, one of the questions was, if there is a very small but non-zero chance that we're burying somebody alive, so do we have to worry about this? So some poskim said no. Some poskim said, the Torah said, lo tolen nevlaso, that you shouldn't delay a kfura. So the Torah is telling you, in spite of the fact the Torah knows that there is a non-zero chance, the Torah told you, do it anyway. So sometimes the Torah overrides the normal rule that any chance of danger whatsoever. Whether these poskim in Eretz Yisrael mean to say, just that the risk is so low that we do it. Some poskim, for example, say that they bring many achronim bring the Mabit. Also in the 16th century, the Mabit said that we don't consider the danger significant because business travelers do it all the time. So he kind of invokes a standard that if normal people with a balanced sense of self-preservation, who are not reckless, if normal people consider the danger manageable and tolerable and something that you're willing to assume for making a living, then you can do it for a mitzvah too. So are they saying any mitzvah? Are they saying specifically Yishuv Eretz Yisrael? Very difficult to know. Most of the poskim don't.
The Yehuda in the hunting tshuva actually does the opposite. Like, if we're living, I'll let you take an extra risk.
Yes. So that's another point that the famous note of Yehuda about hunting, and many other poskim too, specifically say that there is an additional heter to do things for parnasa that would not be permitted for leisure. And Yehuda himself specifically contrasts. He's talking about hunting. He specifically contrasts explicitly hunting for leisure versus hunting for parnasa. He says you're not allowed to do it for hunting for leisure because of the risk. You are allowed to do it for parnasa. And we find the same distinction in a number of other poskim who say that you're allowed to undertake extra risk for parnasa that you wouldn't normally be allowed to. So either the Mabit doesn't hold this distinction, or he holds that the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael has the same level of dispensation, either all mitzvahs or the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael has the same dispensation as parnasa, or I'm not sure. But in any event, yes. So that is an important question. All these poskim who are saying that for the mitzvah of Eretz Yisrael, you're allowed to undertake sakana, do they mean stam because the sakana is very low? Do they mean because for mitzvahs you're allowed to undertake a fairly low degree of sakana? Do they mean specifically for the mitzvah of Eretz Yisrael, which is one of the greatest mitzvahs and one of the greatest values in Judaism? Hard to know. It's an important question. You have to read the individual tshuvas and try to figure out whether their language indicates that it's specific to Eretz Yisrael or for the other reasons in question. Some of them clearly were the whole tshuva, the God only means, the whole tshuva is moved, kind of, he's motivated. Many of the posts can use impassioned language about the importance of going to Eretz Yisrael, so it's certainly very possible that they felt that there was additional dispensation for this great mitzvah, but valid question, certainly not entirely clear in all the tshuvas, how much risk and for how important a mitzvah would they allow it. There's a second question. There's a very, very interesting and charming tshuva, the Me'il Tzedakah. He was asked about, in about 300 years ago in Europe, he was asked about a family who wanted to make Aliyah. There were three families, three good friends, so idealistic men who wanted to make Aliyah. And they were going to bring their families along. They were going to cross the Mediterranean, apparently cross some body of water to get to Eretz Yisrael. And they were willing to undertake the danger and the rigors of the trip. But the local based in the local community was against them. They felt that it was unfair to risk the lives of the children. Unfair to the children. Children are, you can't do that, then who gives you the right to do it to your children? Do it to yourself. You're an adult, make your own decisions, but don't risk the lives of your children. So the Me'il Tzedakah completely and utterly rejects this position. He says they have the right to go and they have the right to take their families. He basically argues that even if there is danger, yes, but they have the right to go, like the lenient position here, that for the mitzvah of Eretz Yisrael, you have the right to undertake a certain level of risk. And then he says, and even if you worry about children, he says it doesn't change anything. And he says, he establishes the basic rule, this is important when we discuss child custody and we discuss parental rights over children, that he basically establishes a principle that anything that a person is allowed to do on his own behalf, as the head of his household, he has the right to do for his minor children. And he argues, he says, and don't tell me the risk is greater for children. He says, no. He says, it's not. He says, what are you worried about? He says, you worried about shipwreck and piracy? Danger is equal for everyone, he says. Adults, children, they're all in the same boat, literally, figuratively. He says, you worried about the rigors of the journey, the upheavals and the stress. He says, on the contrary, he says, children are much more resilient. Children bounce around all day. They're constantly bouncing and bumping and running. He says, if anyone can survive the rigors of a journey, children are much better than adults. They're older, they're rigid, they're creaky. He says, children are great, he says. So Mele, he says, go for it, and no reason to stay because of the children. The minig is, he says, people go all the time. The minig of the people, families who live in seafaring countries, they take their families all the time on ships, he says, and nobody thinks it's particularly dangerous for children. So that's the minig. That's the people who understand these things know there's no danger, and go for it, he says. However, the one, other posts can say similar things too. The one caveat he says, and this spawns a whole further literature too, the one caveat he has is parnasa. He says, all this is if a person will be able to make a living in Eretz Yisrael. He says, but we know Eretz Yisrael, economic conditions are pretty bleak. He says, many people who do have a successful parnasa in Chutz Laaretz will have a hard time in Eretz Yisrael. We'll either have to go without and become paupers, or we'll have to live off chalukah, we'll have to live off tzedakah. Both of those are very bad. He says, anius is a terrible state of affairs because anius is mavra demidas kono, anius is a religious and spiritual challenge. Additionally, he says, living off tzedakah, sonim atanas yichya. Other poskim say it's a terrible way to, Shlomo Kluger and others follow him, it's a terrible way to live. So he says, if the person has parnasa in Chutz Laaretz and very likely won't have parnasa in Eretz Yisrael, that's a serious problem. He says, and even if you as an adult you're idealistic people, you know you can do it, you can tighten your belt and bear it, he says, but your children, he says, you're taking them there, they're going to live without any parnasa, he says, it's a terrible challenge for them. I remember some years ago I was in Eretz Yisrael. I think I think Shabbos Chevron, where they all, the settlers and the Zionists all celebrate their Mesiras Nefesh for Eretz Yisrael. So I was waxing kind of rhapsodic. I was admiring the Mesiras Nefesh of the right wing of the settlers for whatever else you argue about the whether it's good or not. I was just saying at least you have to admire the Mesiras Nefesh. So my host, the fellow who I was staying by for Shabbos, a more Haredi fellow, he was not so happy. He felt, he raised this objection. He says, is it really the right way to raise children, he said, to raise them under Arab gunfire, to subject them to that kind of life? So I told him, I said, people in Mea Sharim, you raise their kids in poverty, I said. Some people would say that that's not the way to raise children. And that's what the Milta Daka said, that taking your kid to Eretz Yisrael and raising him in poverty is also a religious challenge. And yet they do it because the parents think that it's a religious value and they think the kids are taught that's the way to live. He told me no. He said, yeah, but that's the way they're taught and that's the way their parents live and they understand. I said, well, that's the way the people on the hilltops live and there too. So you can debate this thing until the Redeemer comes. I'm not trying to settle the question. But in any event, we do find a number of poskim who were concerned that poverty, especially for children, is a problem and a person should not be exposing his children, should not be forcing unwilling children, at least children who grew up in Chutz Laaretz, to make Aliyah. I think we know people who have moved to Eretz Yisrael, this is a well-known problem that it can lead to difficulty for the children adjusting and in general raising kids in Eretz Yisrael. So that the parnasa is a problem that many poskim have dealt with over the years. That the Rosh Bash himself brought that up as one of the reasons, he says, why a person may not have to go to Eretz Yisrael bizman hazeh. I want to spend a few minutes discussing also the slightly more hashkafic aspect of the question, and that is the controversy over the Shalosh Shvuos. Shalosh Shvuos are the three oaths. This is a Gemara in Ksuvos, in the same Gemara we were discussing earlier. The Gemara says that God made three Shvuos, three covenants, three oaths with both the Jews and the non-Jews. Two of them relate to the Jews. One of them is Shlo Yalu. Yes. Shlo Yalu Yisrael B'choma. They should not make Aliyah, conquer territory. Choma is a hard word to translate. Rashi says, B'choma is Yachad B'yad Chazaka. Three very important words. Yachad, they shouldn't go up jointly, together, and they shouldn't do it B'yad Chazaka, by force, by power. The second shvua is Shlo Yimar Dubumas Ha'olam. They shouldn't rebel against the nations. They shouldn't challenge their sovereignty. The third one is that the Umas are supposed to behave themselves towards us. But some argue that because they haven't lived up to their part of the bargain, Holocaust, Khmelnytsky, Spain, etc., we have enough things that they haven't lived up to their part of the bargain, so all these things are linked. It's a contract, sort of. Some people say they don't apply. Kamarov says, no, they're independent, they're different, and they're not linked. But
so this is a shvuah that who does with whom?
So that's part of the problem. The Gemara isn't a Gadata Gemara. It's not brought in Shulchan Aruch. It's not brought in the Rambam. So some say it's b'chlal very difficult to derive any binding principle from this. The Gemara is not so clear. The Gemara says these are shvuahs that God made. That the language is in Shir HaShirim. It says Hishbati Eschem, I have sworn with you. Very difficult to know that they bring the language of the Rambam, who says it's like a mashal. It means figuratively. It doesn't mean that God actually sat down across the conference table and made a shvuah with us. Difficult to know. It's an Agadat Gemara. Probably can't be taken strictly literally, but it does seem clear that there's some kind of imperative that we're not supposed to be ola b'choma, which Rashi says means by force. So one of the key arguments by many poskim for why modern aliyah, the modern state of Israel, does not violate the Shavua, one of the main arguments is based on the Balfour Declaration and subsequent events. We find a number of poskim who have said that once the United Nations and the British, who were in charge of Israel under the British mandate, once they decided that Palestine would be a homeland for the Jews, the shvuahs no longer apply. We find a number of different poskim and very different worldviews who have made this basic point. One of the most startling, the language and the idea, the most startling is Dar Sameach, Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk. Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk was not a Zionist. If you Google his views in Zionism, you'll find these rabid partisan Satmar anti-Zionist sites who quote him as being a vehement opponent to Zionism. And I think he was to some extent. He was, like many of the great leaders of Eastern Europe at the time, he was vehemently opposed to political Zionism, Herzl and the others. He felt it would lead to a destruction of the traditional character of Judaism. However, topic for a different day, however, there is a letter printed for him. I don't know if this letter is absolutely authentic. I haven't been able to track down any discussion of it, but there is a letter printed for him in one of the journals about 60 years ago, Tufshin Yutes, where he said that Hashkacha, divine providence, which occurred in the form of Asifas Hamamlachos HaMe'oros B'San Remo, the gathering of the enlightened nations in San Remo in 1917, they issued a declaration, the Balfour Declaration, that Eretz Yisrael tia la'am Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael, Palestine, should be a homeland for the Jews. Sar pachan ha'shvuos. This implies that we are no longer concerned about the Gimel Shvuos. And with the permission of the Malachim, Rishayon ha'malachim, the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael comes back in force. Mitzvah on every man, he says, is to do whatever he can to mekayim the mitzvah, and so on. And then he says a fascinating thing. Several weeks ago, we mentioned the eschatological, the hashkafic ideas of Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. He argued that even though some of the earlier redemptions were done by Nevuah, there were prophets and divinely inspired leaders who brought us back to Eretz Yisrael, he says the Geula Shlishis may not be like that. The Geula Shlishis might be supposed to start without prophecy, without direct divine involvement. And he says, Ulai, he says that Kemosha Churban Bayesheni is law Pinavua. Korban Bayis Rishon, there was plenty of prophecy foretelling it. We have Yeshaya, we have Yirmiyah, we have tons of Nevi'im who went on and on warning about the Korban. Bayisheni was not like that. Bayisheni, Nevu'ah was no longer existed. And the Korban just happened B'derech HaTavah without any Nevi'im telling you this is about to happen. So perhaps, he says, just as the Korban Bayisheni happened without overt, explicit, obvious, superficially obvious divine interaction, he says, Kein Yeh Hanochas Evan Pina, so too will be the initial building, the cornerstone of the redemption, Shalal Pinavim, Ukunatilato Kachnasi Nasa. This is basically Rav Kalischer's idea that the Geula Shlishis, we asked for Mashiach and Eliyahu HaNavi, but the beginning may be without Nevuah, without direct and obvious divine providence, and the Balfour Declaration may have been the start of that Geula process. We find the same idea that after the Balfour Declaration, we find that the concern of the Shavuos no longer applies. We find this certainly in some of the more ideologically Zionist poskim, but even Tzitz Eliezer, who was dyed-in-the-wool Zionist, Tzitz Eliezer also has fiery, inspired words about this idea of the Balfour Declaration. He says, the whole problem of the Shavuos was prior that Pukadnu v'Pekida HaGedola, before we've had this great remembrance. He says that He says, Me'oz pocket Hashem osanu l'tova. Hashem remembered us for good. He gave us Shem u'she'eretz be'eretz kodesho. V'yitem b'lev ha'um. He placed in the hearts of the United Nations, just like Koresh in the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, God inspired him to cooperate with the redemption. So too, Hashem inspired the UN to let us back into Eretz Yisrael. And he says, there's no longer any Shvua. The Shvua is only Bechoma. Today, he says, most nations are happy about it. I don't know, today, I'm not sure how much, but back then, he says, the basic source of all this is the Avnei Nezer. Avnei Nezer is apparently Rosh V'Rishon, the primary source for the notion that the Issur is only Bechoma. The Avnei Nezer already said, Rashi said Bechoma, which means Yachad, B'yad Chazaka. If there's Rishus, there's no Yad Chazaka.
The War of Independence?
Yes, so he's not getting involved in the war. Some of these were before the war. The Sad Merov, who was famously the one who opposed all this, he wanted to argue, among other things, apparently, I only had a chance to go through the secondary literature, but he wanted to argue many arguments, but included in that was the UN is not the one in charge. He argued, you know, he was a kind of a conservative skeptic toward international law. He said, law is sovereign nations. Law are the locals. It's the Arabs, if the local Arabs are not cooperating. Others said, it wasn't the Arabs, it was the British. The British were the ones in charge. Halacha recognizes the notion of kibush mulchama. Halacha recognizes that if one nation conquers and annexes and takes over another nation, the new nation is now in charge. The United States is now, the legitimate sovereign government is the United States. Not the Native Americans, in spite of the fact that they were there first and we conquered them. Halacha recognizes that when wars happen, the new government is now the legitimate government. Some poskim argued that the British, in the early 20th century, the British were the masters of Eretz Yisrael. They had taken over from the Ottomans. Rav Shaul Yisraeli, who was a Zionist, Rav Shaul Yisraeli says, again, we follow the UN, he says, recognition of the UN, Bezkus Yisrael, Vade Maspika, that's sufficient, though it's not called Yad Chazaka. Even though he says the Arabs, we don't care, he says, even though he says the neighboring Arabs and the local Palestinian Arabs were opposed, he says this point of Kibush Mulchama, he says the sovereign rulers, the legitimately recognized sovereign rulers of the land were the British, and they were the Anglim, he says, who conquered the land with the sanction of the UN. He says they were the ones in charge. He says, after they, the UN and the British, decided that Palestine would be open to the Jews, he says, even the nations in the UN that opposed, he says, the UN has its own protocols, how they vote and how they decide, so the minority of nations that oppose doesn't matter, he says, it's a democratic process by which the UN reaches a conclusion, and the UN did reach whatever conclusions it reached, he says. Now, he says, even if they change their mind now, it's too late. Once they gave it to us, it's ours, he says. I guess if they were to have a war and chase us out, maybe they would become the owners again, but in the meantime, we have it, he says, they gave it to us. The issur of Choma does not apply. And therefore, these poskim felt that the issur of the Shalosh Shvuos does not apply. Even the Rashbash again, did not feel that people can force each other to go to Eretz Yisrael. Danger was one of his main concerns. But he actually deals with the Shalosh Shvuos also. And he says that... He says that the mitzvah no longer applies to the nation of Israel as a whole. Then he says he makes an interesting kind of lumdish distinction. He says the mitzvah still does apply to individuals. An individual Jew in his private capacity in his time in the 15th century still does have a mitzvah to go to Eretz Israel. However, he says Klal Yisrael and Galus no longer has the mitzvah as a whole, because that's the shvuos that Hashem made. The nation shouldn't, as a whole, as a unified whole, yachad. He's not really discussing the idea of mered, against the will, with permission, without permission. He's saying we distinguish between Klal Yisrael as a whole and individuals. Individuals still have the mitzvah, but the nation as a whole doesn't have a general mitzvah. And we find again the Gadol of Minsk. He explains that this mitzvah, he says, is a unique mitzvah. It's different from all other mitzvahs. He says, other mitzvahs, everyone has to do it without any exception. Just, you have to put on tefillin, he says. But here he says, Hashem was worried that if the Jews would have no holds barred, would just go there to Israel whenever they could, it would cause terrible problems, it would cause political problems, it would cause great problems. So Hashem, for our own safety, for the sake of preserving the Jewish people, Hashem said, Shlo Yalu B'chama.
So by doing that, he reduced and he limited the force of the mitzvah because it's Tzarech Shah, until he says we have again the Peshra and Nifla that. That was the idea of Rameir Balanes, he says, that every dar, that the nation as a whole doesn't go, but they send up some people, they send up a myriad of people. Hashem didn't want the whole nation going because that would lead to problems. But again, many poskim, he was before the Balfour Declaration, many poskim have said, does not apply Bizman Azeh, although again, some, notably the Satmar Rav, felt that the Shavuos was still in force and that any kind of organized, I don't know how far he went, but certainly any kind of organized Aliyah, he felt was still a problem.